to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total photonic reversal.
Photonic reversal.
Photonic reversal with your host, Conan Neutron. Broadcasting from a secret underground lair in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
A gigantic middle finger to everything that is rock about music, rock and roll, and corporate power.
The thing is, though, if you don't laugh, you're going to go on a killing spree with sharpened nails.
Confidence of a hero or a fool, I wasn't exactly certain which.
Could not be more professional.
It means something.
And they got away.
You know, that's my take on it. Like, what's yours?
Protonic reversal!
That's like a science thing, right?
Indeed it is. It is a science thing. It is a science place. It is a scientific fact that we are all up in your face. It is time once again for the one, the only... Protonic Reversal. Welcome to it. Episode 458. Wow, huge number. I keep getting impressed by my own numbers, even after I've done this show for so long. Very excited. In mere moments, going to be talking to Greg Deal of the Dead Pioneers, a super cool band, an awesome artist, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get to it shortly. Before that, welcome to Conan Neutron's Protonic Reversal. I'm your host, Conan Neutron. I'm a rock and roll lifer that's been touring and recording for 26 years, most known for the band Conan Neutron, The Secret Friends. Music is a huge part of my life, and I use the format of this very long-running podcast to talk about music with musicians whose work I enjoy and respect, but who may not be household names. This is episode 458. Now, if it's your first time with the show, archives are available for free. No ads, no sponsors, no kidding at protonicreversal.com. However, if you want to support the show and get episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal will gladly achieve that goal. And if you like the show, even just a single episode, please feel free to like, subscribe on your platform of choice, share it around the internet, even leave a review. All that helps people discover the show. It beats back the almighty algorithmic overlords. That's just a darn nice thing to do. So, all right, Greg Deal. Awesome artist, singer, musician, Dead Pioneers, hell of a band, blazing a trail, some might say. And I would like to welcome Mr. Greg Deal onto the show right now. How you doing, man?
Hey, how are you?
Great. Thanks for spending some time with me. I know it's, you're a busy guy.
So. I mean, yeah, but no, I'm here. And I apologize for delaying your show.
You know what? It's fine. It'll everyone will live. The internet content will survive nonetheless. You got a lot of stuff coming up with this band, not the least of which includes a new record. Why don't you tell me about this new one? How's it a little different? How's it different?
Yeah.
Than Wagon Burner than the one before that.
I don't know. Without sounding too much like a cliche, you know, we're hoping to sort of try to push our sound and kind of obligate ourselves more to the art of it, but also trying to keep the integrity of what we've built, but challenge ourselves with new ideas. I mean, I say this a lot, and maybe it's a cliche, but like, we're old enough that we're not in this for like trying to find relevance in, you know, the twilight of a music career, but it's really the art of it, and kind of taking advantage of the medium that is music and articulating ideas and thoughts that we stand behind. But we've got music that's kind of in that post-punk space. We've got, you know, there's a hardcore song in there I just absolutely love. And, but we're just trying to push the needle forward a bit, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels as if you're, look, there's easier ways to make money or build a career, right? I mean,
for sure.
And that's, you know, that's a through line with this show. You know, I've been doing it a long time. I talked to a lot of different folks. Again, one of the conceits of the show, I make records and tour myself, you know, as an active thing. It isn't something that's like in the past or something that I'm vaguely familiar with. It's part, I'm in that world. But I always find it interesting when someone comes over to it from a different art form, because my understanding is that music wasn't your first art form, or at least being in a band with music is not your first art form. Would that be correct?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it was, kind of a, I had a performance art piece called The Punk Pan-Indian Romantic Comedy, and it was just a, it was a one-man show, and it was about, you know, my relationship with music, the scene that I grew up in, which was a hardcore straight-edge scene in Salt Lake City, and just the relationship I have with that, but it's tied to my family and just how I grew up and how important music was when I was a kid, and the way my parents sort of arranged that. And so this performance piece was sort of a catalyst where it was just like, well, what if we, you know, added some original music to this? You know, between each of these stories, we have a song that I wrote that's relevant to the story I'm talking about. By the time we finished it, it was just like, I mean, like, is it something? Is this something, you know? And just, yeah, we kind of put it out in the world, and it took off. I it wasn't the intent, but that's what happened. And really, you know, we're here for it, but also mystified by how these things sort of catch on. Like, why do they do that?
Right. Like, why is this the thing that connects versus some other thing or something? Yeah. Well, yeah. But there's a vitality to it, right? There's something very alive about it. You know, I'm certainly not going to castigate anybody on this show, but there's bands where you're like, all right, it's enough, isn't it? Like, really? Come on. What are we doing this for? And, you know, which isn't to denigrate art that maybe was made before, but it's like, okay. That's good.
Yeah.
And this has like a real urgency to it. And it's something that, you know, that happens all the time. But I think you got a viewpoint. I think you got a, you know, a place that you're coming from where you want to accomplish the type of music that you're trying to make. And I think it's like, you know, without knocking you over the head with a club about it, I think it's very authoritative in that way.
Yeah, you know, like trying to create something that isn't pointing a finger so much as bringing you along with us. Yeah. I mean, I've got like several years, you know, I have a visual art career that's about 21 plus years deep. And there's activism in that, which, I mean, I don't know, one person calls an activist, another calls an adult with an opinion. But like, sure, I'll take it. You know, we're in these spaces, and I've gone to protests, and I've been about some issues that affect Indian country and beyond. And so the voice has been honed. And then we find ourselves in this sort of post, you know, Black Lives Matter moment where doors have been opened, and not just doors, but I also think hearts, you know, like we're in a place where people are able to hear things that they haven't heard before, and they're in a good position to sort of listen. And so that's been a big factor, I think, in being able to find a moment as well.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, and there's also the aspect of, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, when you're not someone that, you know, more or less looks like me, you're abjectly political, whether you're trying to be or not, just by existing. And that's, you know, so leaning into it in such a way and kind of owning it and turning it into an expression of your art, I think it's,
yeah,
I mean, that's the way to do it as far as I can see. So, yeah, I find that interesting. Did you come up listening to punk rock? Was that something that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the entryway, like, I don't know, skateboard videos. So, which is really sure, kind of the access to,
yeah,
Circle Jerks, Black Flag, you know, Dead Kennedys. And then, the scene was like hardcore. So it was a lot of the New York hardcore, you know, Gorilla Biscuits and Judge, Youth of Today. My first show was Instead. And then, of course, you know, bands like Bold, Integrity, but also Inside Out was for some reason drawn to Salt Lake City. So Zach, like, they did a couple of reunion shows, and one of the reunion shows was in Salt Lake City. And so I had buddies that were like friends with Zach back then, which was right when Rage Against the Machine came out. But it was like, you know, new release, independent, you know, before it got picked up and sort of blew up.
Yeah, and, yeah, I got that. Yeah. I got that first tape that they put out before the record, but I had no frame of reference for it. I was like, oh yeah, cool, you know. Like,
yeah,
I got it from the comic store I went to. It's like, hey, we got these cassettes. You want one of these? I'm like, is it free? He's like, yes. Then I do, and I was like, oh, that's okay, awesome. Rage Against the Machine, interesting. But yeah, yeah, Inside Out. Obviously, I found about that way later. But yeah, you know, the guy was walking the walk. pretty early on,
sure. And sure.
But yeah, very aggressive, like very, very immediate. I mean, not that Rage is like, you know, super nuanced and like wishy-washy.
No,
but
rage is like easy listening for Gen Xers. Yeah,
which is the weirdest thing. Where it's like, are you just not like a lyrics guy? Like, what are you? Okay, you got to wonder sometimes, right? but I think that's interesting because I think we don't hear a lot of stories. I mean, that's like the joke, like a Rage for the Machine, or like, you know, like, oh, the songs of your people, frat boys. But it's like, no. I mean, it's not all like that. Like, you know, that just the representation of, you know, somebody living their experience and just, you know, owning it and like, you know, being like just a freaking incendiary grenade on the ground about it. I mean, that's inspiring, no matter where you're coming from, I think.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
So were you someone that had tried playing before and just like it didn't really vibe with you, or just like doing it for fun, or what?
I mean, the way I kind of saw it was there were bands, you know, like I think at that time, you know, Revelation Records was sort of the big one, and Victory Hardcore was a big one. And so there was like some local Utah bands that were getting signed on Revelation. And so I had music adjacent guys, but like my entryway into the scene was difficult because Utah is very white, and so whether anybody meant it or not, like I didn't really have acceptance in those spaces. So like there were guys I went to school with and they weren't mean to me, but we weren't hanging out, like we weren't necessarily friends, and I'd see them at shows, but I was going to shows in spite of that. And so I just didn't really have access to anybody that played, and so like being in a band wasn't really an option, and I was just sort of a babe in the woods with that stuff and wasn't really sure how to handle it. And I always wanted that. I always thought it would be very cool, but it just, you know, I just didn't have access, and so it just never really happened.
Yeah, and that's something that I think people take for granted, especially if they come from, like, you know, cool cities or whatever, where it's like just like having access to things where it's like a welcoming environment where you're just, you know, you can be just some kid. Like, I think this is cool, and I'm here because I think this is cool, and like you don't have to, you know, be a friend of so-and-so, and you know, just the gatekeeper ishness of it that can kind of happen, especially even in smaller scenes sometimes.
For sure. I mean, like I didn't really have that sort of community experience where like you just show up and you make friends immediately and you're just part of this community and people like care about you. I didn't have that experience until I moved to Washington, D.C., and I lived there for about 17 years.
Oh, yeah.
And like ended up hooking up with like the old D.C. hardcore guys and became friends with lead guitarist for Marginal Man, and like you just there's all these things that are easily connected. And when I moved to Colorado, which is where I'm at now, that's very much there as well, because these are places where there's maybe not a lot of diversity in terms of you know, racial identity, but there's diversity in queerness for sure. So those communities become really important. Utah's just very white, like a lot of the a lot of the straight edge kids, like, you know, were straight edge is kind of has its own set of extremes, but like these kids were so extreme, like a lot of them became white supremacists like later on. And it's I don't know. Utah's a funny thing because I feel like even Hitler would be like, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Like, it's wild, bro.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Asian dude, moved out there for work. Like, it was a like he got a pretty massive promotion, and but it, like he was, you know, a West Coast guy, and I talked to him later. I was like, oh, you know, how is that? He's like, it's weird. I'm like, how so? He's like, everyone knows me by name, including people I've never met, because he's like the Asian guy where it's like, okay, man, that's like, I didn't even think about that, because, you know, being I'm from the Bay Area, and it's like, you know, whatever, wherever you're from doesn't matter, you're here now, we're all here together, you know, it's like very different than a lot of places, which doesn't say that, you know, like whatever, every place has its problems, but like, you know, that tokenism aspect less so.
Totally. I mean, Utah's beautiful, but it's just weird, man. There's a weird culture there. And some people can do it. Like, I live in Colorado for a reason, because I don't want to raise my family there. I got five kids and they don't need that.
Right. Well, I mean, hey, that's real talk, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
You gotta do what's right for you and your people. When you first come together, you had done performance art before. What about making records? Was that like a familiar world to you at all? Or was that like a new experience?
No, I mean, I've dealt with sound in so much as like you might use it for filmmaking, but like, I mean, we're really talking about a different set of standards and sciences, you know, like, but I'm a sponge too. Like I just, we recorded at the Blasting Room, which is Bill Stevenson's
legendary spot. Yeah.
And just even being in the control room, watching them kind of work all the mixing. And yeah, I mean, I feel like I've learned a lot quickly. All of my guys are seasoned professionals and they've been very kind and patient with me as I've like learned how a lot of this stuff works. And listen, I have a kid who, or two kids at this point that really want to do music, and like having access enough to be like, well, this is how this works and this is how this works has been really helpful for them, because it's a whole other animal. Like it really is.
It is. And for folks that have never done it, be like, oh yeah, yeah, I get it. I'm like, I know you think you get it, but it's very different than you think it is. Like things that quote unquote sound big in the room, that's just not how it works recording. You know, like it's a different world. It's a different set of, and I know, and you know, like history is filled with bands that were just like absolutely stellar live, and like, you know, all the records are like, ooh, boy, that didn't really. and then there's bands that make like great records, and they, you know, and live they're like, oh, okay, that's all right, I guess. You know, and,
you know,
that's a different
something thing I was really concerned about though. Like, I wanted to make sure that like we sound consistent in that, and so I think sticking to the simplest thing has helped us sort of be able to capture that, so that what you hear live is.
Right, because you're not trying to Pink Floyd it out or something, right? Yeah, you're trying to. Well, but it's interesting to me that. So how old were you when you made the first record? When you made the first one? Like,
oh gosh,
I don't mean to narc you out. I know it's not cool sometimes for people to share that.
No, you're fine. So I would have been 48.
Yeah,
so I'm 51 now. So 48. I mean, that was 3 years ago.
yeah, and that's, you know, that's atypical, but it wasn't like you were coming at art from a foreign environment. You were, it wasn't your medium. It's like working in a different medium suddenly, right?
I certainly wasn't like a teenager, you know, filled with piss and vinegar, you know, with a chip on my shoulder, like pretty malleable coming in and just ready to make something. I just wanted to make something good if I couldn't make something great.
Well, I find that kind of interesting, and I think about things like, you know, Bukowski didn't write his first poem until he was like 35, you know, like Picasso was like late in life started it. Like, you know, where people, I think if you come at things from perspective of not having that adolescent thing going on, it's going to hit entirely different. And because it occurs to me that the Dead Pioneer stuff, just, there's a real kind of statement of intent immediately to it. I'm just like, oh no, this is like, there's no like dicking around. This is getting right to the point. And I think that maybe comes with, you know, just being like a fully formed personality with fully formed opinions and what, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it is, but I think it's interesting. It's an interesting take.
You know, it's funny. Was I told my wife, we don't make enough money that I can afford a midlife crisis. So like, I'm just having an existential one. And
Breach.
And really this feels like an extension to that. So like when I was in my early 40s, I had this sort of epiphany where I realized that there's all this trauma in my early part of my life that I haven't really reconciled. And part of that like trauma was my father kicking me out when I was 17 and me like realizing that I had to abandon my record collection. And I never stopped listening to music. I never stopped going to shows, but like I had to leave something behind. And from when I was like 20 or 17 until I got married when I was 24, I think I moved no less than like 28 times and realized that lack of permanence that I had in that moment, I carried that clear until I was 40. So my birthday's coming up and my wife's just like, what do you want for your birthday? And I'm like, nothing. Like I'm a grown ass man. I don't need a birthday present. And she's like, well, you were talking about a turntable. And I was like, yeah, but then I suddenly like I spiraled. I was like, but if I get a turntable, like what if I get a bunch of records and then we have to move and then I got to move all those records. And but what if I don't have any money and I can't buy any records? I got this turntable and like two records. Like how dumb is that? And I just was spiraling and my wife just had the wherewithal to be like, dude, like just get the record. And what happened was, is I ended up like, I hate saying this cause it's so cliche, but I took this journey where I was like revisiting my old record collection, and I was revisiting records I grew up with, and I was listening to it differently because I'm going through the analog process of taking it out of the sleeve, putting it on the record player, and just like engaging it with purpose. And that ended up going into my work, and then it went into my writing, and that's where the punk pan Indian romantic comedy came up. And so the concept, like with writing that first record in particularly, was I wanted to write what I wish I could have heard when I was a kid. And so everything is connected back to that. So I'm old enough to remember what I wanted, but also old enough to like actually navigate it without, you know, without any real trouble.
Oh, right, right. And have articulated in such a way that you're getting across the message without maybe the emotions of the passion getting in the way. It can be used as a force of good. You know, this all hits very much home for me. I mean, I moved 14 times before the age of 17. Like, I definitely did not have a lot of permanence with my location. So, therefore, touring life is great for me. You know, like, wherever I lay my head is home. Great. That's I'm used to that. You know, I think I stopped counting at 30, but I understand that's also not the experience of a lot of folks. And some people would find that, you know, incredibly stressful. And it's like, if that's your life, that's just your life. And that's your experience. So tell me the process, because you did that first, the self-titled one was the first 2023, right? Tell me between doing the art piece into like the band and recording, how did that process look like? Like how quick of an evolution was that?
I mean, I suppose on paper it wasn't terribly quick because we started working on it in 2020, and I was working with my drummer Shane and one of my guitarists Josh, and it was just an idea, and we were only kind of going off like spoken word with punk riffs, like what does that look like, and had some ideas. But then COVID hit like immediately, and we just like, you can't make music, especially somebody who's never made music remotely. You got to be in a room together. It's a vibe, and you got to kind of be in it together. And you just can't do that over Zoom. And
it's not going to have the same effect. Yeah.
I had a residency in 2021 in Florida, and it was this massive residency. And I was actually a mentor to six visual and performance artists.
All right.
And there was also a music mentor, and there was a poetry mentor. And in the music section was the lead guitarist for this band called Algiers, sort of a post-punk industrial gospel. Like, they're worth checking out. They're very cool. I'm out of Atlanta. And Lee knew my work, and I knew who the Algiers was. And we just got to talking, and so this project came up, and I explained it to him, and I shared with him this piece I wrote the day before in about an hour, and was like, you know, I feel like this might be a good candidate, like spoken word, punk riffs, and everything else. We got into a studio that was on the campus we were at, set up the shitty drum set, set up some mics, ran through it a couple times, like an idea. It was bass line heavy, so we just did a bass line and the drums. And we pressed record in under 2 hours, and we had Bad Indian, which is our most listened to track.
Right. Which is just sometimes how it goes, right? It's just like it's like that what's that first LCD sound system single?
No,
it's like,
totally.
I remember hearing that at a bar and be like, oh, that's a catchy little tune, without even like realizing, oh, it's like, that's the guy from Speed King, you know? It was like, and then like, oh, is that the same band they heard the bar? Wow, crazy. but that one's also just like pops right off the speakers, right? It's intense. It's got a lived experience. It's got a position. It's got, you know, you have something to say, but it's also a good song, right? So, I mean, none of that would matter.
Yeah,
if the song
sucked. The original is 6 minutes long, which I was told you can't have a 6 minute long punk song. So, the revised version.
The Wipers would like to disagree, but yes, I understand. Yeah.
So the we have a 3 minute version. That's the one that we have on streaming. But I sent that to Josh and Shane, and so I'm like, we have a starting point, and all of us were sort of like, oh, okay. So that was 2021. We got together in 2022. We were going to do like a 3 day writing session, and then we were going to go straight to the Blasting Room and record what we came up with. Mm-hmm. And I had raised money to do it. We flew Lee out. He lives in Florida. And we got into a room on the first day. We wrote, no joke, 8 songs in one shot. But at the end of the day...
And for those that are not musicians that are listening, because this is a very musician-heavy listenership, that's a lot. That's
it's a little insane.
That's like crazy. Like, I am prolific. I ain't that prolific. You know, like it's like that is like you are striking not just a goal. Like you've hit platinum. Like that's nuts.
I mean, we had some riffs going back and forth. So I mean, we came in with stuff, but like we laid it down, got a demo. But at the end of that day, I was like, man, I don't feel good. And turns out that I tested positive for COVID. So we had to quit and then reschedule, you know, the blasting room. We rescheduled the blasting room, kind of fell through, tried to reschedule it again, fell through, rescheduled it one final time, which was, I think, early February 2023. And we were ready to go.
And now it's got to suck because you know you have something cool. You know, you have something like, oh, this is great. But you're in this process of like, can we ever get this into the world? Maybe that would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, so we get ready to record. Josh has a death in the family. He can't make it.
Oh, my God.
Lee is in town with Algiers. He was going to stay over, but he had a family emergency. He's like, I'll email you the bass riffs. So it was just me and Shane. And Shane's like, without Josh, like, what can we do? And I'm like, man, we already wrote it. There has to be someone who can play it. He's like, maybe I know somebody. So he calls somebody who's Abe Brennan, who's our other guitarist now. But he learned everything in 2 days, showed up to the studio in a blizzard. It was like, you talk about like all the elements are coming at us.
Right. I was going to say like, what's it's like the five obstructions. Like what's happening next? Like locust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We recorded the entire first album in 2 days. So we wrote it in one, recorded it in two, late nights. But we pulled it off and in true form and fashion, I introduced a new song in the middle of all that we flushed out on a lunch and then recorded it when our engineer got back. So,
awesome.
yeah. And that's how it came together. And it was like, by the time it was mixed and mastered by, I think, April or so. And then I was like, should we put it out in the world? And I just put it on streaming, in September, 2023. And we pressed some records and we sold out of the records we pressed. That's and amazing. Like within 5 months, everything just kind of started blowing up. It was really strange.
Yeah, because then you know, AT puts out the Bad Indian, you know, which of course, you know, were you a Jello fan? Were you like familiar with the legacy of Alternative Tentacles?
Yeah, for sure. So I met Jello in that would have been, I think, January 2024, because he grew up in Colorado, and so he was in town for the holidays. So we threw a show together. It was our first show, like our first real live show. So because we knew Jello was going to show up.
Sure, yeah.
He told me they weren't, they were a small outfit and they weren't signing anybody.
Yeah.
By February, we had something like 500,000 streams, like complete independent release. Yeah. And we had just a natural 500,000 streams. On the biggest streaming platform that we shall not name.
Exactly. We don't need to say it.
And that got us a record deal with Passel Records. Jello was very bummed out about that, but really wanted to put out a 7-inch. So in partnership with Passel Records, we did the 7-inch on Alternative Tentacles.
Yeah, which is great, because not only is that, you know, good representation, it's also Alternative Tentacles. You talk about like the
bucket list. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a political punk. The next two words are Alternative Tentacles, right?
I mean, for sure.
I've got that the Chumbawamba and Noam Chomsky split. You know what I mean? It's like, how I found out about Noam Chomsky. It's like, okay. So that's kind of sets you on your way, right? And so, and then was the idea always like, hey, let's bring this, you know, let's take this show on the road. Like, we got something interesting here. Let's do it. Or what did that kind of come like? Oh, well, okay, I guess people like this. Like,
I knew I had more music in me. And we really felt like, you know, a fire, lightning in a bottle, I guess. But like, I wasn't willing to do it if we didn't have support, because it was a massive pain in the ass to pack all the boxes and ship out records. It was terrible.
I do it all the time. It's the worst. I hate it.
And so I wanted support, you know, for distribution. And so Hassel came along And we all talked about it. It's like, I mean, it's a 3-record deal. Let's see what it is. The first record is a reissue of the one we re.
Yeah, it's the one you already did. So okay, it's a
2-record deal,
right? Exactly. Yeah. but you also get a day in the sun for something that wouldn't have had those resources before. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right.
But while all that's happening, like I took that first record before we signed and I sent it to everybody I knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I know Jeff Ament, you know, the bassist for Pearl Jam, and I know what kind of music he likes, and I sent it to him with the caveat, I don't want anything from you. I just thought you would appreciate
it. Yeah, check it out. Sure.
And he's the reason why we got on Pearl Jam's radar. And so, like, we ended up opening for Pearl Jam in April 2025, and then we ended up on the road with Pennywise and Propagandhi and Comeback Kid in Europe. And so, like, it's just honestly one. I mean, we got a KEXP run in last February.
That's right. Yeah.
We like all these insane things that just keep happening.
Well, an opportunity is like that. It's like, you know, if a boulder starts rolling down a hill, a lot of times, like, you know, it'll pick up steam, and that's great.
Yeah.
It's not everybody's story, though. And for people that try to, like, you know, expect that, it's like, well, good luck to you. I mean, maybe.
We'll I mean, see. Listen, my wife 100% was like, what are you doing? Like, like, you can't be serious. But, like, she...
Yes, the ones we love with the pins for your balloons always, yeah.
We're totally, you know, my wife and I are totally different. And she just loves Pearl Jam. So, for her...
So that's kind of like a nice little... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, our anniversary was May 1st, and that was our last show with Pearl Jam in front of 19,000 people in Atlanta. Yeah.
Sounds
and I
okay.
flew her out for our anniversary. Yeah. So she saw us play, and then we get a little bit of validation because we're with Pearl Jam. And then she, I think at that moment, was like, okay, like, I see what you're doing. Like, here we go. You know, let's see how it goes.
That's a real shot in the arm for viability when when you get like a showpiece like that, right? I mean, you know.
Okay, on that last day with Pearl Jam, they pulled us on stage. So we were singing Rockin' in the Free World. Hitting tambourines like an asshole, like you're on stage, just like trying to keep your hands busy, I guess.
But
at the end of the song, Eddie Vedder comes up and like dabs me out and says, "We're so glad you guys are with us, you know, for this run." And so, you know, those things are the cool things that happen, and just I feel incredibly fortunate. I love what we're doing. And also just feel like there's a younger version of me that's like, really? Like, really? It's just crazy.
Sure. And by all accounts, everyone I ever talked to is like anybody in Pearl Jam and in their world, there's like the sweetest, coolest people like you'll ever meet, basically. And to an almost alarming degree of just like, all right, I get it. They're great.
Yeah, and like, it's funny because we sometimes get, you know, those pure punkers that are just like,
let's go punk rock.
And it's like,
yeah,
you know,
okay,
what,
whatever,
dude, you can
you
think whatever you want about Pearl Jam. They had our little indigenous punk band on stage in the South with like half the crowd being MAGA, singing about working class stuff, singing about indigenous rights, and Pearl Jam supported us. So they are always going to be okay in my book.
They're
always
posting up where it counts, you know? And
totally.
It's like, talk about a band that learned all the right lessons from Fugazi, which isn't just sound like Fugazi, which is what a lot of people seem to try to do, which, like, I mean, great. I like that band too. You know? Have you heard another one? No, so that's great. That gives you like a much larger platform. That gives you like a larger base of folks to work with. So tell me about how Post American comes to pass.
So we released a record, and then that summer we were just like, let's just do it. Like, let's just jump in the studio. Let's get another. We need a beefier set list anyway, so like we need to really kind of get things moving. That first record is 22 minutes long. I mean,
totally. It's like one of those like old school like SST records or something, like Minutemen Joy or something.
Yeah.
What, that's it? Okay. Well,
yeah.
All right.
And so we got to writing, and it was interesting because, you know, politically there was a political race happening over the presidency.
Yeah.
And so we were writing kind of to that. And then, you know, suddenly we reach this point where, you know, Trump ends up back into office, and like these songs that were, you know, seemingly relevant became more so. Mm-hmm. Just even with the song Post American, it's the idea of like everything that's happening that we're America, if there's an identity, and I'm speaking in general terms, I have an opinion about that, but like in general terms, if there's an identity, it's being lost in this political moment. And that's like a tough pill to swallow. So like, that's where post-American, the concept of post-American came from.
Right. Cause it used to be something that could transcend, political viewpoints and whatnot. Like now it's like, oh no, those are like a unified thing, and like you just have to just feel shame and annoyance and anger all the time now if you don't believe that, which I have strong thoughts on as well, as you might be able to tell. but it also reminds me of, like, you're hitting the moment of like one of the reasons why Idols hit it really big is because they were the things that some people found annoying or not to their sensibility, I should say, about Idols, which is just like the real, just like, I hate fascists, let's punch the fascists. Just the real, just like, whoa, that's just, you're just putting it right out there, right? It was seeing those guys play and just like seeing kids that like, they don't know from Jesus Lizard or like Pixies or like Fugazi or, any of this stuff. And they're just in the moment having an amazing time together and like they're having like this like incredible catharsis. It's like, oh, so like, in these nuanceless times, like you kind of do have to, I guess, not that that's the only way, but you kind of do have to just like say what you mean, don't hold back. Don't hide it behind some kind of flowery language or anything along those lines. Like this is the moment for telling people exactly who you are, I think. And it took me seeing that language.
Right.
But took me seeing that and being like, oh shit, okay, I get it. Oh, okay, right on. Cause it sounds dumb. I've been listening to, quote unquote punk rock music, aggressive music, political music, whatever, my entire life.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, I guess this is what we're doing now. All right, cool. Right on. Now I know.
No,
and there's definite immediacy, but it isn't without humor to what you guys do.
Yeah, no,
it's deadly serious, but it's also there's, it works. It works.
Yeah, I mean, but like there's also cultural nuance to it. I mean, you can look at Bad Indian, for example, like, those first lines are, they're serious, but they're also funny, right? It's like, my last name is in a sentence. I don't have enough beadwork or turquoise, and I don't speak good pigeon English, certainly not as good as Johnny Depp did in that movie that one time.
Right.
But then... The second line, too, is just like it's telling a story, a true story of like somebody asking me my Indian name and recognizing that like that's a trope that exists. Maybe I have one. Maybe I don't. And I play into it by saying it's Greg and finish with a joke that's actually a Charlie Hill joke. Our first like mainstream indigenous comedian who worked with Richard Pryor. With the Walking Eagle joke. But then you get to the end, which is more angry, whereas the guy that says, you speak real good for a Native American. And after I say that, I list, an Indian, a godless heathen, a savage. I say wagon burner on the record. It says, prairie N-word, which is bleeped out. But that is pointing to the fact that like it doesn't matter if he calls me indigenous or an Indian or a savage, like the inflection is essentially the same because of what he's saying. And so there's nuance to what we're putting in there, but we're not this one-dimensional group of people. Like humor is a really big part of being native. And if you get around native people, like we'll hurt your feelings and just give you a hard time for fun. And it's a love language though. It's vastly important.
That I've only really seen, so the reality of which I've known that has only really seen somewhat portrayed well in Reservation Dogs, which is a freaking brilliant and hilarious show, but also just getting that like exactly right where it's like, oh wow, I've never seen that in a show. That's kind of bad. And it also sounds to be a good show, which is, otherwise it wasn't a good show, it wouldn't matter. But what's it, Sterling Harjo?
Harjo.
Really freaking cool that like I've not seen, and I've had friends, because like whatever, especially if you're in punk rock and you play like Montana a lot and you play like so these areas where they have a huge like native population, then like again, just by osmosis you're gonna get some like native rock and roll friends. And I just thought that was so neat to actually see that and have it depict that, but not as tokenism, what I mean? Like it wasn't like, hey everybody, check it out, we're doing this. Like, all right, great.
Yeah.
Here's your trophy,
I mean, even, you know, for reservation dogs, like even, you know, the Indian on a horse.
Right.
Dallas Goldtooth.
Yeah. Like, yeah. That dude rules. I love that guy.
He's even bucking that trope by just like messing about and like saying things that you don't expect him to say.
It's completely
There's a humanization that comes with it. And it's fantastic. So we have to do that. You know, like Bad Indian plays that role.
Totally.
We have a song on the new record, Wagon Burner, that is it's about political violence. Like if you speak violence, don't be surprised when it shows up at your door. Yeah. But the song is called Circle Jerk the Wagons. And, you know, like playing off of that stuff. And in fact, we recorded a song that I'm hoping we get to release here in the coming, not this year, probably next year, but it's called Day in the Life of a White Supremacist. And it is full in, like, it's about a white supremacist and like who lives an entire life of really inconsistency. Like, how do you hate people when you have to compromise every? So he drives a Japanese car because it's cheaper, and he right. he buys coffee that was harvested in a country that he's supposed to hate, he gets his dry cleaner from a minority family that, you know, wishes him a good day, and he says thanks, you too, but then he's mad at himself because he's supposed to hate them. And eventually goes to a cross burning because he's a KKK guy and accidentally lights himself on fire. And so it's this whole storyline. And like, but that stuff, because it is like, this stuff is so like racism and fascism and you know, xenophobia and homophobia. Like that stuff is so, if it wasn't so damn sad, it would just be hilarious that it exists at all.
Yeah, I think you see, yeah, right. So there's some great satire back in the day, I think, that does that really well. But I feel like that's, it's like you can't satirize it now because you're just surrounded by it. Like it's just so upfront. By the way, everyone, like, you know, in Europe being high and mighty, you guys, like, have just been, please, let's not the pot call the kettle black here. I mean, come on. Like, you can be an Auslander. That's all I'm going to say. All right. But I think that, you know, all that comes across and, you know, it's a righteous anger, but it's an intelligent one. And I think one of the problems I have is when it's like, you know, like with the suburban angst and rage focused at nothing. Oh, I'm mad at my dad. Okay, well, maybe your dad does suck. I don't know, but it's a lot more bigger things to be mad about, bro. I mean, it's like, okay.
Sure.
And I think that's important. And I do want to talk a little bit about Wagon Burner. But while we're talking, I want to, so let's talk about the second record a little bit. How'd that come to pass? So you're right around now, you know, right around.
Well,
shows.
It's interesting because we're just writing it, and so we're still from my perspective, we're still in that kind of innocent place where we haven't played a ton of shows. Our influences are like not really, you know, we're not having experiences that is influencing our writing. So we're still writing in that same place that we were for the first record. Which is really interesting because it ultimately ends up creating a sort of a second act to the first record, like a truly second act to the first record.
Yeah, right, like a continuation. Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and like I wrote a song about appropriation. Like how, like you want to talk about, you know, trying to write about something that's really hard. Like, because people either care about that or they don't. But
right.
like we wrote something. And called it My Spirit Animal, H, Your Spirit Animal.
Yeah, I know that one, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, we were able to, like, really kind of pull some things together for that. And the difference between that and, like, the third record especially is that we were on the road and we spent a lot of time with Fletcher from Pennywise. And these things ended up really playing a role in sort of developing, like, let's do a song that's like this. Let's create something that's like this and so we could explore a little more because we're having experiences. So I think the second record really is just sort of a second act to the first record. Like if we'd had a bigger budget and we had more time to write, this is what we would have written.
More nuance, going a little deeper. Sure. I mean, and then also, yeah, you're getting to try it out in front of, you know, a sea of baseball hats every night, you know, like that's
yes.
And there's something to be said if you're doing something that's where the message is the medium and the medium is the message to a certain degree. Like that's great. That's you're winning just by like being there and throwing down everything you can. And if people come along for the ride, all the better. But you're challenging preconceptions while not just, you know, hey, everybody, I'm challenging your preconceptions. You're actually doing something cool. And then it happens to be the also cool result for that. So I think that.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's a good place to be. And it's an important distinction from my world, believe me. So then post-American, so between post-American and this one, there's like not a lot of time in between there. So was it just like you had stuff like stocked up? Like, or was it just, were you just feeling that motivated by the daily?
All the above. I think all the above. I mean, we had some stuff we didn't do anything with on the last one, so we pulled that together. We did the same thing. Like, we wrote, I think, for 2.5 days, and then we recorded the entire post-American, I think, in 4 days or less. And it was actually really interesting because, like, Abe didn't write with us on the first record, so I told him, I'm like, this is how it's going to work. You know, we get together, we flush all this stuff out, and then we like get into the studio and we just record it. And he's like, yeah, that's not how that works. Like he's been doing this for 35 years. And he's like, you don't write that way. I was like, I mean, we do. And he's like, yeah, we'll see. And then that's exactly what happens.
It's not one size fits all. It's whatever works, right? I mean, like, you know, like it doesn't sound that crazy to me. It's just that like, not what a lot of bands do, but that's fine.
I have somehow convinced these guys to write, and if it's good enough, it's the first thing is usually the best thing, and let's move on and get to the next one. And that's actually how I produce a lot of my work. So there's no noodling. Everybody's got their hands on it. It's as good as it's going to be. Okay, let's move to the next one.
You are speaking my language. These are things I say all the time. You know, first decision's usually best, right? You know, when in doubt, take it out. Yeah. I got all these aphorisms that are all things that, like, believe me, I was doing it wrong for years. You're lucky to have come up with that and not waste everybody's time, including your own. With that.
That's it gets expensive.
Well, it sure does. Yeah. You hear these bands like doinking around the studio. It's like, I'm sorry, why are you even in the studio then? Like you don't have any ideas? Like, I mean, why? Yeah, anyway, that's a separate line of inquiry. So that it works then, right? He's there with everyone this time, and it's like, all right, you know, SOB, it works.
There's not a lot of ego happening actually either. So like we're all in this together. All working together. Everybody's being teachable and malleable to the situation. And also not taking things personally. You know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
And you can't take time to be precious.
No. Like, well, you know, I see what you're doing with that, but maybe like try this instead. And everybody's kind of, we're working together. That is a big part of it because there's a lot of love and a lot of respect in the room. So,
well, and when you have people, that you know what you can do, you know how to play with each other, then a certain degree it unlocks a different level of skill to be able to just like, all right, let's try it. I think this will be cool. And like you know intrinsically there becomes this like telepathy almost that you can have a back and forth that can create really fantastic results, you know, and that's one of the reasons why the attitude of the people involved can be just as important as the skill level, frankly, if they're, you know, someone's
for sure,
all, you know, all blocked up.
We feel really lucky with our crew. Like I genuinely love all of these guys and I just feel very fortunate that we have that.
Yeah, it seems like everyone's very aligned with the purpose too of like, you know, hey, like let's this is what we're doing. We're going this way. You know, well, what about that way? What about that way? No, let's go this way. Let's go.
And on some level, I mean, this is what allyship looks like, right? Like, I'm indigenous. Josh is Mexican indigenous. And then Abe, Lee, and
hey, halfway
Shane
to Redbone.
Yeah, well, we call Shane and Abe and Lee like our DEI hires, our race traders. They're the best we could do. No.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, we have fun with it, but like, we all know the assignment and we're all here doing this thing together. So, yeah.
So tell me more about Wagon Burner. I heard Nazi Teeth was the first one that I heard, which is, again, just like, hey, everybody, here's this, you know, wham. Yeah, okay.
You can't spend any amount of time with Propagandhi and not like, we need an anti-fascist song. Like we need something. And before we released that, we actually played The Only Good Fascist Is Very Dead Fascist.
I think we played
it twice, maybe three times, and only one time did it honestly work. And then we were just like, after the third time, it's like, we can't play this. We're screwing it up. It's not good. But we played it when it counted and it was all good. And then we released Nazi Teeth. And so now we have that song.
You have your version of that, right?
Yeah. We did, what is it? We did that with Cheap Perfume. There's a Riot Girl band who's, you know, famous for their song, It's Okay to Punch Nazis, 2016. And then that's where we started. We went to No Kings, titles on the nose, but it's very much about just sort of everything that's happening. And then I've known the Interrupters since 2020. I did a mural, and it's a portrait of a Native person, and they're wearing an Interrupters T-shirt, and they found out about it. The figure has a red handprint over their face, so it's about missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. And when the Interrupters found out, they wanted to support that, and they have been so kind to my oldest kid, who's the person in the portrait, and like. Interrupters, this was, you know, they were 14 years old and Interrupters are their favorite band, and they were just so incredibly kind. So every time they come into town, we're with them. So like the same way with, you know, Jeff Amit, I sent our record to them and just said, hey, just sharing, you know, nothing.
Just sharing your art.
They came to town and I was like, hey, you guys need to come to, you know, to the mural so we can do pictures. And I had my whole family come down, all five kids and my wife and I, and with the Interrupters. But when Amy jumped out of the van when they got there, she goes, I'm obsessed with Dead Pioneers. I'm like, really? Like, okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like, that's rad. And then the next time they were in town, Amy was like, when are we going to do a song? And I was like, I mean, the second record's already done. And she's like, I'm sure your second record's great. It'd be better if we were on it. And I was like, yeah, it's already done, but let's plan on something. And then the next time I saw them, I had a plan. And then the last time we saw them, which was last year in LA, I was like, we're going in, we're recording it. Like, here's the plan. This is what we're doing. And they were about to go into the studio. So the timing was perfect.
Timing's perfect.
We were able to pull it all together. They saved my ass on that track because I wasn't sure how to approach it lyrically or vocally. And Amy was like, let me just do the chorus and maybe that'll help. And I was like, yeah, like, let's do that. And when we got the chorus, like, it all gelled together. They just consummate professionals. The Interrupters are just really perfectionists about what they do and how they do it. And Kevin, of course, you know, mixing, helping mix it and adding some instruments to the track and like really kind of getting us over the finish line on that was fantastic.
That rules. I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
And then, of course, go ahead.
No, it's just good people. You know, there's some good people in the industry and those guys are good people.
Well, it's always nice when you meet them, and it's even better when you get, you know, get to collaborate.
Yeah, and I mean, they're like family at this point. So, like, yeah, it's cool. And then we did a song with Jason.
Yeah, Jason Williamson from Sleaford.
Sleaford Mods.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a shot in the dark, man. I'm really surprised we got that. Super humbled that we got that. But when Lee and I first started talking about this in 2021, I was like, these are some of my ideas. And he's like, yeah, you should listen to these guys, you know, Sleaford Mods and their yellow record, Spare Rib. And I listened to it. Yeah. I was obsessed with it. And so it feels full circle that we had them as an inspiration in the beginning, and then we arrive at this place where we get to actually do a track.
You get to collaborate. I remember I heard that Job Seeker song, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. What the hell is this?
Yeah.
I was like, this is really cool.
It really is like a what the hell is this, but also just like in such a fantastic
new way. Absolutely. And then I heard the one with the VHS, I can't remember what it's called right now, but it's like this, what is this production? Like, what is, like, and they've gradually like, upped their game a little bit, but I'm like, it sounds like it could be on, and I mean this as a compliment, it sounds like it could be on K Records or something, but it's coming so hard at the same time. And like, I've kind of liked how they've brought in more hi-fi sensibilities to what they do and, you know, kind of evolved it a little bit, but it hasn't like lost track of what made it cool in the first place. Dude's fierce. Like, that's great.
Also, just a good dude. Like, and I mean, it comes out in his music too, but like, solid dude. We've been corresponding ever since. And I really, really like Jason, respect him a lot, and just super proud to have him on that song that just released this week.
Yeah, that's the most recent one. Yeah, at the time of this recording. Yeah. Would love to have that dude on sometime. I put zero effort into making that happening. But, like, I would love to have him on. That'd be great. I think that'd be a good conversation. But that happens a lot with this show. Dude. So, cool record. You're taking the show on the road, right? Like, you got to, you know, by the time people hear it, it'll be too late. But I know you're playing Permanent Records, which I like a lot. And you're playing Denver. And then you're off to UK, Ireland, Europe, et cetera, right?
Yeah, we're playing 2000 Trees Festival in England. And then we are playing Timberfest up near Seattle. And we're doing a show in Missoula. I believe it's an indigenous conference. And
fantastic. I love Missoula.
So we're going to kick that off.
Missoula is an underrated American city, and I'll go on record as saying that.
It is. It is. And I think, you know, Jeff Ament's up that way, so I think he might help us out with the back line. So we're...
always helps to know a dude with amps.
We are, yes. But we're also, like, trying to figure out what the rest of the year looks like. We're trying to get on the East Coast to do a run. Yeah. We want to do a Chicago, Minneapolis run. We want to do, an Oklahoma, Texas run, another, you know, a Southwest run. And I would love to come back to California because Southern California has been very, very kind to us. And also just, it's a good place to play.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like I live in Milwaukee, but I'm from Oakland, California. And so most of my touring life has been on the West Coast and, to this day, it's still my strongest area. So I end up playing there like more often than not. And I'm always like, it's great.
It is great.
Turns out
we're doing. I would like to point out, like, we are playing a show in Denver on
Real
the
Aerodyne.
3rd of July, which is, we're calling it Dead Pioneers Day.
Nice. Okay, cool.
Merciless Indian Savages and Friends, that's the way that we're referred to in the Declaration of Independence. But it is the day before white independence, and we're just planning on having a good time with it.
That's great. That's great. This will definitely be out before then, so hopefully if folks are within easy radius to be able to check that out, they can hear it. Cool stuff. Wagon Burner's cool record. You know, I think you're on a good one right now. I'm glad we get to make this happen. Anything else you'd like to get to before we start closing out here?
There's a rumor we might be playing at the Stanley, which is the hotel shot.
I know exactly what the Stanley is, my guy. I've been there. Shining is top 10 movie for me, right? I mean, I know exactly what the Stanley is. But tell the listeners. Yeah.
We're talking, so it's where they shot The Shining. It's supposed to be like the most haunted hotel in the country. It's in the mountains of Colorado, Estes Park. Near Boulder, but we're looking at trying to do a weekend. But what it's going to be different because I think we're going to add some things to it that make our show a little bit more theatrical, not over the top, but just like something that allows storytelling to sort of exist. Probably going to do the punk pandemonium romantic comedy at one point.
Okay.
And really just kind of make a weekend of it. But like, I think that one will be a good time.
What a great opportunity!
Sure.
That's badass, dude. Because I've been there, and it's you know, it's awesome. But like
we're hoping to do a live too, like live at the Stanley. Like we'll record both nights and kind of figure that out from there.
That's like up there with like Live at Pompeii or something. Of like just like hell yeah, people. If you know, you know. You're like yes.
Yeah. No, we're very very excited about that. But also, you know, it feels like a next step. You know, like we can take some of my performance art aspect and try to figure out a way to integrate it into the show in a way that's natural and sort of amplifies, you know, what we're doing in terms of the storytelling and the message. So
absolutely. Well, I hope we get the chance to check it out at some point. Hey, this has been great. This is the final question. It's the only canned question that I ever ask. And you can choose to interpret it however you like.
Okay.
Why do you do what you do?
Love of the game, man. I mean, I create because I feel compelled to create, and I take it seriously. As an Indigenous person, we look at our artists and our creators as medicine people. And I don't know if I would call myself a medicine person, but I accept the responsibility that I have with it, and feel like that if I am given something, that I'm beholden to that thing. And so I create because I feel compelled to, and I'm happy to do so. And I feel very fortunate to be able to do that.
Great deal. Thanks so much, man. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, man. Take care. All right, there he goes. Great deal. Check out Dead Pioneers near you. Also, you can listen to Wagon Burner, all the normal places that you listen to the musics. You know, let's play The Worst Among Us. That's the one that featured Jason Williamson. Play it out. Here it goes.
One time I was showing at the Smithsonian Museum the audacity. Red man in a white building. You were concerned I'd exercise my freedom. Push against the pricks, as they say. Your fear seeps like a gas leak, waiting for a spark. An excuse for violence, for murder, for boots on necks, knees in backs. Tear gas, pepper spray, big government's afraid of little old me.
The worst among us cast shadows long. The worst among us. The worst among us strip my souls. Kill for profit, imperialize. The worst among us cast shadows long. The worst among us. The worst among us own it all.
Everyone wants us natives to shut the fuck up. We're outside the radius of the story many Americans have heard, have told themselves, have been indoctrinated with. They grabbed and they still grab. Nabbing lands, traditions, stories, symbols, mineral rights with cunning chicanery or beady-eyed brute force. Erasing bloodlines, deleting history.
Cast shadows long. Worst among us. Worst among us. Strip my souls. Kill for profit. Imperialize. Worst among us. Cast shadows long. Worst among us. Worst among us. Own it all. Kill for profit. Colonize.
Why did you think you're gonna kill them all? Where the options are known. Why did you think you're gonna kill them on sight? Why did you think you're gonna kill them on sight? Why did you think you're gonna kill them on sight? Why did you think you're gonna kill them on sight?
The worst among us cast shadows long. The worst among us. The worst among us strip my souls. Kill for profit. Among us cast shadows fall. The worst among us. The worst among us own it all. Kill for profit, colonize. The worst among us crash and clench. The worst among us. The worst among us strip my souls.
All right. Wow, that was a great deal. And the Dead Pioneers with a special guest from across the pond, Jason Williamson of Sleaford Mods. Worst Among Us, that's on the album Wagon Burner. You can get that at deadpioneers.bandcamp.com. They got a bunch of vinyl options, crystal clear vinyl, CDs, all that stuff. Anyway, fascinating dude. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. I certainly did. You, of course, have been listening to Conan and Transportronic Reversal. I thank you so much for listening to it. The show airs Thursdays, 8 Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, 5 Pacific, streaming live on YouTube and Twitch. Podcasted later everywhere, always free, no ads, no sponsors, no kidding, ProtonicReversal.com. But if you like joining one episode sooner, $1 a month at Patreon.com/ProtonicReversal. We'll achieve that goal. Get you those episodes sooner and helps keep the lights on in this joint. That is deeply appreciated. Thanks for folks liking and subscribing on your platform of choice, sharing around the internet, even leaving a review. Mr. and Mrs. America. All that helps people discover the show. Beats back the almighty algorithm, and it's just a darn nice thing to do. So thank you for doing that. Much appreciated. Some good stuff happening. Yeah. Post-Catterwall. It's all post-Catterwall. My life is Catterwall right now, dude. So stay tuned. Some really cool stuff coming up. So keep that subscribe button. I don't know. Keep it pushed? I don't even know where I'm going with that. But stay tuned is what I'm trying to tell you, right? And, you know, stay safe out there. Turn sound into electricity. And as always,
can you hear me now?
I'll check you later.
Out on Route 128, dark and lonely. I got my radio on. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Welcome to my top 10. I'd like to thank our sponsor. But we haven't got a sponsor. Not if you were the last man on earth. She was prepared to prove it. This one goes out to a special girl. There is no special girl! It's the end of radio! The last announcer plays the last record. The last what? Leaves the transmitter. Circles the globe in search of a listener. Can you hear me now? Can you-
it really broadcasting if there's no one there to receive? It's the end of radio. As we come to the close of our broadcast day, radio. Can you hear me now? Emergency!